from WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Chef Michael Solomonoff talks about bringing modern Israeli cuisine to America in his Philadelphia restaurant, Zahav. Solomonoff was born in Israel and grew up in Pittsburgh. In spite of Zahav's national acclaim, he says it's not the Michelin-rated meals he's eaten that inspire him.
It's the pots of rice. It's the savory pastries that my grandmother made that, you know, if I can close my eyes right now, I can still taste.
Solomonoff won a James Beard Award, but when he opened Zahav in 2008, he was struggling with drug addiction. He's written a new book about Israeli cooking. Also, David Bianculli reviews tomorrow's season premiere of American Horror Story. This season co-stars Lady Gaga. And Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Los Lobos. That's coming up on Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, NPR's Planet Money. It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like how Price Club and its imitators made shopping harder and why customers loved it. Plus, useful stuff like the inside story behind the resurrection of the Hydrox cookie. You can find Planet Money at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Our guest, James Beard Award-winning chef Michael Solomonoff, has earned a national reputation for his unique take on the cuisine of Israel. Solomonoff grew up mostly in the U.S., but has strong family ties to Israel. The 35-year-old chef and his business partner Steve Cook have opened several restaurants in Philadelphia, and as the New York Times' Frank Bruni revealed in a column last year, Solomonoff did a lot of that while battling a serious drug addiction. His flagship restaurant is called Zahav, which is the Hebrew word for gold. As it happens, Zahav is only a few blocks away from WHYY, which gave our contributor Dave Davies the chance to take an enviable research trip. He spent an evening at Zahav, hanging out in the kitchen, watching Solomonoff work the bread station and oversee the preparation of hundreds of delicious offerings for customers. And every few minutes, he'd slip Dave one of the restaurant's memorable dishes to sample. Yesterday, Solomonoff came to our studio to talk with Dave about his new cookbook, which is co-authored with Steve Cook. It's called Zahav, A World of Israeli Cooking.
Well, Michael Solomonoff, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, so much of the cookbook is about Israel and your connection to Israel, but I thought we'd talk about that for a moment. You were born in Israel but moved to Pittsburgh as a kid, right, and really grew up as an American. Did you feel a connection to Israel growing up?
I did feel a connection. It was just very – it was muted. You know, we didn't really speak Hebrew in the house. My parents spoke Hebrew when they were trying to, like, hide something from me, and there were little sort of bits – of Israel in the house, you know, whether it would be like something that we would have on the dinner table that was a little bit strange, or, you know, my dad's like accent, or whenever there would be, you know, conflict on the news while we were eating dinner, we would have to be quiet, sort of. So there, it was there, but it was sort of in the background.
So your family moved back to Israel when you were like a teenager, 15 or so?
I was 15, yeah. We moved back when I was 15.
How'd you take to it?
Not well. Not very well. I think the year before – I mean, it's a tough age anyways, I think, and I was a little bit disobedient. I don't know. I was like a pretty crazy kid, so I – it was already sort of a weird time for me, and I – the ensuing threat of moving, you know, across the world basically really bothered me. So I acted out, and I was like crazy, and then we moved over to Israel, and I was generally unhappy, but – you know, in hindsight, some of my closest friends are from that year, and a lot of that year really shaped sort of who I am today.
The year in Israel.
Yes.
Right. And you had a younger brother, David.
Yeah.
3 years younger?
3 years and four, like, school, like, grade years, you know. See, he was 3 years younger than me, but I think he was, like, four grades.
So you're 15, which is not an easy age for a kid to make an adjustment. He was more like, what,
12? Yeah.
How did he do in Israel?
Well, before we moved, he was gung-ho. And then we got there, and I think it was very difficult. I went to an American boarding school, and he assimilated into like the Israeli public school system. So I think it was really difficult for him. I mean, 15 is a tough age, but 12, 13 is also not easy. And I think that being immersed in a new culture, learning a new language, and just dealing with all that was really difficult.
And but he eventually kind of connected with Israel in a way that you didn't, right? You came back to the States.
Well, he became Israeli, and I, you know, there was Israeli identity that was like manifested after I was there, but it was different. I was hanging out with American kids, and I was having, you know, an experience in Israel. My brother eventually was going to go to the army. It's like a very different mindset. You know, I was sort of dipping my toe into Israel where he, you know, was sort of immersed in it.
And tell us what happened to your brother after that.
Well, so I came back from that trip and I guess that was in August and then the end of August and went back to work. And then on October 6th, which was Yom Kippur that year, I was driving back from Pittsburgh. I had picked up my dad's old car that was going to be my brother's when he finished with the military and moved back to the States. And I got a call saying that he had been killed in action, which is, I mean, obviously shocking, but we had all assumed that he was done. He was 3 or 4 days away or so from finishing his military service. And he was patrolling the border with Lebanon, which again was like strange because it was so quiet. I mean, I think he and his group, they were spending a lot of time in Gaza and in the West Bank. And, you know, the border with Lebanon at that time, that was before the war, the most recent war with Hezbollah. So it was like very, very quiet. And he was patrolling on Yom Kippur and three snipers, Hezbollah snipers that were in Lebanon, fired over the border and killed him.
I mean, any military death is tragic, but it's particularly heartbreaking that he was days away from finishing his service and I think filling in for a more religious soldier who wanted to be off on Yom Kippur.
He was. He shouldn't have actually even been on that mission.
We're recording this interview on Monday, but it's being broadcast on the day, which I guess is the anniversary of your brother's death.
Yes.
Do you have any ritual associated with the anniversary? Is it a different day for you?
It's always different, and I think that in general the high holidays are always kind of a weird period. Like, you know, fall sort of starts happening, and I feel like I need to crawl under a rock a little bit. So, no, I it changes every year, the way in which I sort of react to it. I mean, this year the book happens to be coming out on that day, which – you know, is difficult. I mean, October 6th isn't an easy day. It's also the anniversary of the Yom Kippur War in Israel, so it's not just me that's grieving that day. But I think, in a way, you know, you just sort of have to accept these things. And I think that maybe there's something serendipitous about that that could be also a little bit positive. You know,
we're speaking with Michael Solomonov. He co-owns a restaurant in Philadelphia called Zahav, which has innovative takes on Israeli cooking. And he has a new cookbook called Zahav, A World of Israeli Cooking. You'd gone to culinary school. You'd been a sous chef at a well-known Philadelphia restaurant when the idea of opening Zahav, this Israeli restaurant, came up with you and your partner, Steve Cook. The restaurant opened in 2008. It was a unique kind of venue, and the food was really unique. But you struggled at first. I mean, there was a point where you had to stop taking a salary and you were kind of cutting back on staff.
We had such a hard opening. 2008 was not an easy year, I think, anywhere to open
recession.
A small business. Certainly an Israeli restaurant that nobody knew. Nobody knew what Israeli anything was. And what was happening that year? Okay, so the economy was tanking. The Phillies were in the World Series, which is great for Philly, not great if you're a new restaurant. And Obama was being elected, basically, and it was just like nobody was coming out. And I was struggling with addiction and had to have like an intervention and go to rehab. You know, it was just – there were so many awful things happening, and Steve and I were completely in the weeds. We did not – you know, we didn't take paychecks for a very long time, and if we did, it was like minimal. And, you know, it took about a year or so to get back to being healthy.
You know, you mentioned addiction, and well, let's talk about that for a moment. This is something that had been happening for years. You'd used like pot, I guess, in earlier years.
But yeah.
When you got into the depths of this, you were actually using crack and heroin at the same time. Seriously. I mean, boy, you don't do things halfway.
I don't. I think that, you know, towards the end of it, I mean, things were just sort of falling apart. And unfortunately, that's how it goes with addiction. I mean, it's progressive, right? So as a kid, I'm like wild and, you know, you experiment with pot and alcohol. And then if you've got the gene or if the context is right, you end up sort of almost dying or in jail or whatever. And I just kind of feel like that's how it went with me. And then I, of course, the problem with addiction is that you drag everybody down with you. So my wife, my business partner, every one of our employees, all these people unfortunately get affected by this sort of behavior.
What was your life like in the depths of this?
I don't know. I feel like the sun did not come out for like the last 5 months before I went to rehab. So it was no sleeping, pretty much. It was a lot of running around. It was a lot of making weird, weird excuses for why I was late, where I was, what I had to do. My behavior was completely erratic. I was not a good manager. I was not a good leader. I couldn't inspire anybody.
You'd disappear at night, wake up in the middle of the night, go off?
I wouldn't really wake up. I just didn't do a lot of sleeping. I think that I would get back to my house at like 5 or 6 in the morning and pretend to be asleep and then get up at 8 or 9 or whatever and get to work. And then eventually that stopped working. You know, for so long I could do that. I could get by with no sleep. But then, you know, I'd wake up at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon with like 20 missed calls and people just, you know, where are you? And yeah.
One of the things that's interesting to me about this is addiction can take over people's lives and ruin marriages and jobs and everything. But you were actually, you know, at least on the surface, a pretty productive human being. I mean, you were running this big restaurant. Do you think that there was a line there that would prevent you from destroying yourself, that the restaurant was important enough that you were not going to let the drugs take over?
No, I don't actually. I think that it would have been a matter of time that I would have destroyed everything that I had control to do. And I think that I continue to be surrounded by people that are loving and supportive and that care. And it's also, you know, in their best interest that I don't like get arrested or die. I mean, I think it would have been a matter of time. I think the thing is, you know, you talk to all these people and they're like, well, now you have kids. It must be so easy to stay clean. And you're like, no. If I were still using, I would just manipulate my children or I would steal from them. It doesn't, you know, for me at least, it wasn't about that. I think eventually it would have just caught up with me and I would have stolen or done whatever I had to do. I had enough people and I was ready to stop. I mean, it was just too much for me and I wasn't happy. And wasn't happy. I was like miserable. I felt like I was dying, you know, and I was ready to stop, and I had people that were in my corner that were there to support me and to get me help and to be there for me for like not only up until I went to rehab, but I mean for the first year, I didn't drive by myself. I wasn't by myself. I mean, I didn't carry money on me. Steve would pick me up every single day, drive me into work, talk to me, make sure I was okay, get me, you know, whatever support I needed. And my wife would pick me up every single night and drive me home. And it was like I needed that.
You needed the controls. You were not to be left alone with time and resources.
I couldn't do it. I really couldn't do it. You know, I'd go into autopilot if I did. And I think that I didn't think it was going to be like that. I didn't think I would have to sort of give everything up and just get, you know, everyone's like strong willpower. It's not about that. I mean, if you want to go head to head with like addiction, you're going to lose.
So you had the intervention, you went to rehab, and you've been clean and sober now for 6 years?
October 28th will be 7 years.
That's great.
Yeah.
I wanted to come back and connect this with the story of the restaurant.
Sure.
I mean, do you think when you were using that you were a different kind of chef? I mean, apart from the exhaustion and stamina issues.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I don't think I was very considerate. I mean, I didn't respect, obviously, the business and you know, the partnership that I had. And I think that it's such a selfish thing. I mean, it's hard to consider other people. It's hard to consider diners. It's hard to consider your employees, and yeah, of course, totally different.
In your restaurant, you don't strictly adhere to kosher rules, but you incorporate some of them. Which ones? Why?
Yeah. Well, we say that we're kosher style. We don't serve milk and meat on a plate together, and we don't serve shrimp. We don't serve like shellfish or pork. And The reason we did that was it would help identify what Israeli food was. That was like a big thing. It's not, I eat treif. I mean, I love it. I don't, you know, it's delicious.
Treif is a term you might want to explain for some of our audience.
Treif is non-kosher food. Think bacon mostly. Mm-hmm. Okay. But for us, and even though people in Israel eat treif and people mix milk and meat and all that, it's just culturally it doesn't happen quite as often, right? So when you are serving, for example, steak here in the States, you might put compound butter on it, or you might baste, or particularly lamb, right? That's a big thing. Lamb and yogurt, right? Huge in the Middle East, huge in the Mediterranean. In Israel, tchina would be, or sesame paste would be substituted for that. And we found that to be very relevant, you know? You can serve – like milk and meat is delicious. In Israel, it's served much less, and I feel like it helps give a profile to the food. If we're roasting lamb legs and serving tzatziki with it, then it's delicious. It's fine. You could definitely find it in some places in Israel. But why – then it's just Turkish or it's Greek, and we really wanted to define Israeli food.
All right. The cookbook starts out with tahina.
Yes, it does. Life begins. And on the first day, God created tahina. Right. Well, tahina is sort of like the Israeli mother sauce, right? It's like the – bitter, and it's the sweet, and it's the rich. So it's used for savory. It's used for sweet. It's eaten by itself. If you're me, you eat it out of a jar. It's used to make hummus. It's used to make desserts. It's, you know, everything.
Explain how you make it.
What we do is we get a tahina paste, or like a sesame puree. The seeds come from Ethiopia. They are processed in Nazareth in Israel, and then they're shipped here. And then what we do is take a mixture of lemon and garlic and a little bit of ice water and salt and cumin, and we make this sort of like aerated mother sauce, this like savory sauce that goes – that you can add to chickpeas to make hummus, or you can just, you know, simply put on like grilled meat as a sauce. It's fantastic.
Now that's tahina sauce.
Yes.
Tahina itself is just simply pureed, sesame paste.
It's sesame paste. It's just pure sesame butter that goes through a process that eliminates all the water so it stays nice and thick. It gets toasted. Yeah.
And you say if you ever see a jar of tahina with more than one ingredient, drop it and run.
That's it. Yeah, throw it out. Or don't throw it out, but just go away from it.
You say you haven't seen many culinary problems that tahina couldn't solve. Yeah. What are some of the ways you use it?
Well, you can use it to enrich sauces, which I find to be very good. I think that a little bit of tahina to glaze vegetables is fantastic. I mean, we're used to – coming from a sort of French or Italian background, you know, you use dairy to help bind, to help enrich, to help emulsify, and which is great. I mean, I love it. I think it's really good, just not for Israeli food. It's, you know, it's the tahina is what does that. So we do sort of a riff on, you know, like the green bean casserole that you make for Thanksgiving that has got like the soup mix that you like dump in like cream of mushroom soup or whatever. We saute cremini mushrooms and we lightly blanch haricot vert, and then we dress them with tahina to give it a richness, to give it like implied dairy, but when in fact it's just the sesame butter. So it's a bit healthy and it's definitely a little bit more interesting, and you don't have to like open a can of soup for it.
Right.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but still.
Hummus is a big part of the book, and you said that let me get this right, that it was the hardest thing for you to figure out. Why?
Well, it's still sort of the most challenging thing. There's no tricks and there's no bells and whistles to hummus. It's like got to be just made right. There's very few ingredients, and you know, the way that people are super possessive and provincial and weird about things like burgers or pizza or barbecue, hummus is one of those things that people, if you don't get right, they just freak out. And our, you know, I work at the – well, you saw where I work. I work at the pass where the bread station is, and I'm totally visible to the dining room. And there are times where if we don't get something right that is so personal to somebody, they will literally come over to the pass and tell me that I'm doing it wrong.
A customer will do this?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And it's cool. I mean, it's – at the time, I don't think it's that cool, but it's you know, people take food very seriously and it's very dear to their heart. And for a lot of people, They haven't been back home in a long time. And this is our way to take them back home, to transport them momentarily.
You know, hummus is something that 20 years ago nobody in America ate very much. Now you can find it in all these tubs in supermarkets. You don't think highly of that particular product.
You know what? It's funny. Everyone's like, you must have great hummus at your house. And I'm like, the truth is, I don't cook a lot in my house and I work a bunch. So my wife, I don't make fun of her when she buys store-bought hummus. I don't judge. I may eat it sometimes with like peeled carrot sticks at night, maybe. You know, I just feel like there's a huge difference between the store-bought stuff and the stuff that we make.
You write that hummus should never be refrigerated. That's not to say served refrigerated. It should never be refrigerated, right?
We make our hummus and we serve it. I think the temperature is a really big thing, and I think that a lot of people are used to like cold dips. But the truth is all the nuances and the richness that you get and the robustness from the chickpeas and the butteriness of the tahina, all that is sort of pronounced when it's at room temperature.
That's why it's so good.
I think so.
You grill a lot at Zahav.
Right.
How is it distinct from grilling at other places?
Well, we use charcoal only, and most of the protein that we cook is on little shipudim, or like little skewers that they suspend right over the charcoal. We use a grill grate for things like fish or things like eggplant that you can't really skewer. And the rest of it, though, it's almost like extreme hot smoking.
And why do you do it that way? What's distinctive about the flavor?
Well, it's unique to Israel and the Middle East and a lot of Arabia, and I just think that it is amazing. I mean, I think it's, you know, being that close to the charcoal, extremely hot charcoal is, I don't know, the flavor is just fantastic. And we cook kebabs, which are like ground meat mixtures that are like heavily spiced and distinct to the region that we want to represent. The kofta, if it's like Bulgarian, do the black pepper and the paprika. And if it's Romanian style, we use like tons of garlic. We make lamb merguez, which is North African, you know, with like harissa, and it's piquant. So there's an easy way to sort of to get these like cultural nuances into the meat, right? And then if it's shishlik, like chunks of meat, we marinate them usually with a mixture of onion juice. Which sounds, I know it sounds crazy, but onions have got all this sugar and acid, so it helps break down the meat. Plus, it caramelizes really, really nicely over the charcoal, and that gives it itself a distinct flavor. So we do chicken shishlik, you know, which is like a chicken thigh, and we take amba, which is like a fermented mango pickle, and puree that with onion and garlic, and just let the meat sort of soak in that for a while, and then grill it, and it's just, you know, it's special.
It is special. And of course, grills in a lot of restaurants simply mean what, a propane burner over a grill.
Right. It means like a grill grate. And there's nothing wrong with that. I just feel like for what we're trying to do, you need the charcoal.
One of the interesting parts of the book is you write about cooking rice, which
yes.
is something that everybody does all
right.
the time. And
right.
you write about I think you describe him as your half-brother-in-law, Avi Moore.
Yeah.
And how even though you'd been cooking professionally for years, his rice was a revelation.
Yes.
Why?
Yeah. Well, he's Persian, and you know, he cooks rice with tariq, so it's like this crust on the bottom of it that is developed. And I think it's, you know,
it's the crust of kind of some rice that's just burned enough at the bottom.
Exactly.
It's absolutely delicious.
It's the best. It's what you give to the guests. It's like the best part. It tastes like popcorn a little bit, or almonds. It's so, so good. It's not impossible to make very well, but it's not very easy. What's interesting, though, is that you get this perfect crust, and then you get these great grains of rice that are fluffy, still intact, and still have got all this integrity. So you've got this sort of pluralistic pot of rice that's happening, which is, you know, from where I come from, we use chemicals, we sous vide, we, you know, confit, we do all these like fancy things, we do sauce work. But I mean, nailing a pot of Persian rice is like very, very difficult. So I was struck by that. Also, maybe the older I get, the more I'm just like, I am uninterested in things that are incredibly complex, and the simple things are more impressive to me, and also make these memories. I mean, that's the real thing. You know, you cook all these like fancy things. You cook for these great chefs. You maybe go to Europe and maybe not. But what are the things that make that make me excited to cook? Or what are the memories that I've had that have sort of steered me to being a chef, or more importantly, being in hospitality, inviting people in to, you know, make them food and to serve them and to have them feel sort of special for that moment in my house or in my restaurant. And it's not the Michelin-rated meals that I've had before. It's the pots of rice. It's the savory pastries that my grandmother made that, you know, if I can close my eyes right now, I can still taste. That's what we want to convey in the restaurant, and that's what we want to convey with the book.
Is street food in Israel an inspiration to you?
Street food is absolutely an inspiration. I think it's almost what I crave the most when I go back there.
What are your favorites?
Well, there's like the shawarma falafel, which is good, and you can kind of find that all over the place. And there's arguably better ones in different locations. I like traveling for that sort of thing. Sabich is really good. Do you know what that is?
No.
So it's fried eggplant. It's stuffed in pita with hard-boiled eggs and tchina and like the amba, the mango pickle. So, so good. Ugh, delicious. And there is malawach, which is like a Yemenite flatbread that's kind of like this like layered, laminated, puffy, kind of greasy bread that you like roll up and stuff with like tomatoes or fresh cheese. And there are just like kebab sandwiches that you get. In Jerusalem, there's actually Jerusalem Grill or Jerusalem Mix Grill, which is like a bunch of organ meat minced, put on like a plancha, also stuffed inside with pita. So good.
You know, one thing you can that people know about the restaurant business is how intense it is when things are busy. And that's certainly something I observed when I was there. And, it made me think about your experience with addiction. And I think restaurant people, they, you know, do 4 or 5 hours or more. That's just this really crazed, intense thing. And I wonder if it makes people more inclined to, you know, use chemicals to come down or to stay up. And
well, it's interesting that you say that. I mean, I think that it's possible. I think that, you know, the rush that you get from cooking or being in a, you know, volatile sort of environment, I think can sometimes replace maybe the substance. I don't know. I go home right tonight. I go home after work now. I walk home. I live 2 blocks away. I walk home. I listen to a song. And then I, on my walk home with headphones and put like a hoodie on. And then I like watch TV for like 45 minutes and drink chamomile tea. And then I go to sleep.
What do you watch on TV?
I actually watch horror movies. Like a lot of, I don't know. So maybe that's an argument against, I don't know. So in any case, that's what I do now. I don't go out really. I mean, sometimes we'll go out and I'll like eat food, but I try not to eat that late at night. And I feel like it's very difficult to go home after you've sort of, you know, saved the world or whatever. You know, as line cooks, you think that you're like, you know, you're sort of destroying the comet that's going to explode, right? Like you think you're going to save the world. And
You're sending 200 people away happy, you know, I mean.
Listen, it's a lot of work and you don't do it for that long if you don't love it and you don't think it's important. And we're not necessarily saving the world, but there are, you know, 200 people every single night that we change, that we create this special environment for a few hours. And that to me is I guess my life's work, right? So it's very, very hard to go from doing that to going directly to sleep. You know, it doesn't really work. So it's natural to go out to maybe have a couple drinks and wind down. And, you know, if you've got a insane personality, it's natural to drink like many beers or party or do whatever. So I don't, it's not as easy as just like going home.
You have a really busy life. You've got all these businesses. You get in the kitchen as often as you can.
Yes.
What's food like at your house? What do you and your family eat?
Oh, God. I knew you were going to ask that. Let's see. Food. My wife is a fantastic cook, and we've got two like little kids. So I don't know. It's probably oftentimes eating like organic, like chicken fingers over the sink, trying to get them to eat stuff. Luckily, my kids have always liked. Our oldest two has always enjoyed Asian noodle soup, and pizza, and like brisket, and that is a gift. That's a blessing, you know. But I don't know. Like I made the other night, I just like slow roasted some meat and put it over like buttered noodles. And I got one of our kids to eat a little bit of it, and the rest my wife and I ate over the sink. So,
God, I would think you'd be bringing home delicious bags from Sahav. No?
No, we don't do that. our oldest came in and ate hummus and spit it out on the plate, like in the dining room, and I was like, dude, come on, have some respect. This might be paying for your college one of these days, you know?
Were you a picky eater as a kid yourself?
Oh, my God, I was the worst eater. The worst. Yeah, I like ate nothing. I would take pizzas and like take the cheese off of them and wipe the sauce off and put the cheese back on. And yeah, it's hilarious to my family that I became a chef.
And when did it change? When did you get a real interest in food?
Actually, when I started cooking, I did. I started cooking in Israel when I was like 18 years old. I was 18.
At a bakery, right?
At a bakery, and then I as a short order cook at a cafe, and I really loved. I think I loved sort of creating and building and formulating things. I was definitely inspired by that, and I enjoyed the camaraderie of the kitchen and then I started to love to eat.
Well, Michael Solomonov, it's been fun. Thanks so much.
Chef Michael Solomonov spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is WHYY's senior reporter. Solomonov is the co-author of the new book Zahav, A World of Israeli Cooking, and he co-owns Zahav Restaurant in Philadelphia. After we take a short break, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new Los Lobos album. This is Fresh Air.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by Vonage. In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service, making it better. After such a feat, who would have blamed Vonage if they said, "Enjoy better world, we'll be carving up the ski slopes." But today, Vonage is not on the slopes, shredding the way only Vonage can shred, but is back to work, transforming communications for your business with award-winning cloud-based solutions. See how your business can get the better it deserves. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
The band Los Lobos, which is now in its fourth decade of music making, has a new album called Gates of Gold. It's their first studio album since 2010. Rock critic Ken Tucker says this album captures every phase of the band's career while saluting musical influences and extending their sound in new directions.
Full of thick, mysterious music, Gates of Gold consists of Los Lobos songs that could have emerged from dreams or nightmares. The band's ability to summon up lonely landscapes and feelings of worry and dread is in full force here. The song that started this review is called Made to Break Your Heart. And as it proceeds, it's revealed that the thing that's made to break your heart is love. And heartbreak is one of the things David Hidalgo's voice was made to convey. There are a wide variety of styles on this album, which takes a couple of fun side trips into blues rock. Los Lobos does its version of ZZ Top on Mistreater Boogie Blues. And if you're going to nod to the influence of Jimi Hendrix, Too Small Heart is the way to do it. All aggressive bluster and serene confidence.
Got it.
best music on Gates of Gold is the stuff that is most musically opaque and discursive, with lyrics that are willfully vague. On a song like There I Go, Hidalgo sings quietly over a shuffling drum pattern. Conrad Lozano's bass creeps along like a fugitive trying to escape a spotlight. The lyric, written like most of the songs here by Hidalgo and guitarist Luis Perez, is something about wandering, searching. Chasing forever is a key phrase. There's a kind of doom-struck melancholy to a song whose lines include, "Following the shadow of a dream." The centerpiece of this album is its title song, one of the best things Los Lobos has ever recorded. Gates of Gold begins with a guitar figure that sounds almost like a mandolin. You think maybe the band is dipping into country. And it is, but it's more like a country blues. When Hidalgo starts to sing, the song shifts. Is Gates of Gold a song about death, the pearly gates becoming golden gates opening into heaven? Or is it a more earthbound destination, a journey each of us takes in life, hoping to find some comfort and satisfaction? This is the open-ended approach Los Lobos is so good at creating. Gates of Gold may be a very personal song for the band, their acknowledgement that, after decades of music making, there are still more places they want, they need, to go.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Gates of Gold, the new release from Los Lobos. Lady Gaga stars in the new season of the FX series American Horror Story, which begins tomorrow night. We'll hear David Bianculli's review after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, NPR's Planet Money. It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like how Price Club and its imitators made shopping harder and why customers loved it. Plus, useful stuff like the inside story behind the resurrection of the Hydrox cookie. You can find Planet Money at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow night, the FX series American Horror Story returns with a new edition called Hotel, and a new star, Lady Gaga. Our TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
One of the newest trends on TV, and one of the most intriguing, is the season-long anthology drama series. In the golden age of TV, back in the 1950s, anthology series presented a brand new story and cast every week. A lonely butcher named Marty looking for love. Jurors arguing over a verdict in 12 Angry Men. Mannequins coming to life in the Twilight Zone. Then the anthology format all but vanished, except for the rare, noteworthy revival over the past few decades. HBO's Tales from the Crypt, Showtime's Shelley Duvall's Fairy Tale Theater, Nickelodeon's Are You Afraid of the Dark? But over the past few years, something strange has happened. A few television series have begun reinventing and rebooting themselves, presenting shorter seasons of 10 episodes or so, then returning the next year with all new stories and settings, and partly or completely new casts. These new shows are anthology series, except they're starting from scratch each year instead of each week. HBO's True Detective is one of these new-style anthology shows and demonstrates both the appeal and the risk. Season 1 was terrific, largely because its limited number of episodes allowed the show to land Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson as leads. But Season 2, with different stars and a weaker story, suffered so much by comparison that Andy Samberg ridiculed it at this year's Emmys. FX's Fargo, after a great first season, begins Season 2 next week with what looks to be another strong year. And this week, the series that pioneered the new anthology trend, FX's American Horror Story, returns for Season 5. It's titled Hotel and set in one, a lavishly designed, spooky old place with secrets, ghosts, and other scares and thrills behind every door. Previous seasons have been set in a haunted house, an asylum, a school for witches, and a freak show carnival. And all of them have starred Jessica Lange, who won Best Actress Emmy Awards twice for two different roles. She's not back this season. But Kathy Bates, another Emmy winner for one of her several American Horror Story supporting roles, is, with a new role that may turn out to be her best yet on this series. She plays Iris, the hotel reception clerk. And Iris is so surly, sarcastic, and unhelpful, she gives even Basil Fawlty from Fawlty Towers a run for his money as the nastiest innkeeper in TV history. Here she is, welcoming some new guests to the Hotel Cortez in Los Angeles, a pair of young women from abroad who have just arrived but don't like the look of the place.
You the first time. Reservations?
For us, your hotel is not right. You will please give us back our deposit?
No refunds.
But we need the money for the new hotel.
Welcome to America.
Other actors from the American Horror Story repertory cast are back, also in new roles. And by this point, it's fun to see how differently they will appear and behave. Last season, Sarah Paulson played conjoined twins, both of them. This year, she plays Sally, a combination junkie, punk, and siren. Evan Peters, who has appeared in every incarnation of this anthology series, is back again too, as are repeat players Dennis O'Hare and Angela Bassett. And there are some new additions, including Wes Bentley, Matt Bomer, and, most prominently of all, pop star Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga has replaced Jessica Lange this season as the central focus of American Horror Story. Her character, known simply as the Countess, is bloodthirsty in a literal sense as well as a figurative one. Her stylish ways with her victims, male and female, bring to mind Catherine Deneuve in The Hunger. For much of this year's opener, Lady Gaga glides through without speaking, looking great but saying nothing, like the shimmering star of a silent horror film. She even watches one by going to an outdoor movie in a cemetery where hipster locals picnic near graves while watching Nosferatu. But when the Countess finally does speak, showing a young boy around some of the more hidden parts of her hotel, she makes quite a chilling impact. She's got a slithery, seductive presence that screams evil, even though the actual screaming in this opening hour happens elsewhere.
People aren't supposed to live in hotels.
Well, maybe this place is special. I want to show you something you'll enjoy. We'll only be gone a moment.
I lived in New York many years ago. I loved roaming the streets, devouring the pulse of the city. Electrifying. I miss it very much. Did your father give you a choice when it came time to leave?
My dad says I'm not supposed to talk to strangers.
We're not strangers, Lachlan. We're going to be great friends. Here we are.
What's so special about Hallway?
You'll have to tune in and see, but what's behind that false wall knocked me out. The creators of the American Horror Story franchise, Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk, sometimes seem to enjoy creating new worlds and shows rather than sticking with them. So sometimes a good start doesn't always result in a satisfying ultimate conclusion, as with their musical series Glee. But the one-season length of American Horror Story seems to suit them just fine. And it's impossible to wander through this first hour of Hotel without wondering, with great expectation, just what else is behind some of those doors. For this audaciously designed anthology series, this is the most visually arresting and twisted one yet. And given the history of American Horror Story, that's both a compliment and a warning.
David Bianculli is the founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches television and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, I'll talk with the director and the star of the film Son of Saul. Set in the death camp Auschwitz in 1944, it's about the Sonderkommandos, the Jews who were forced by the Nazis to herd people into the gas chambers, remove the bodies, load them in the ovens, and dump the ashes. Son of Saul won the grand prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Ribaldonato, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.